Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
And we are back. Friday morning, the day after Game 6 of the NBA Finals. Beck, I don't even want to call it the day after Game 6 because I only went to bed a couple of hours ago. You, I believe, have not gone to bed yet. I'm sort of like staring at you on my screen and you're blurry because I'm just too tired to be able to fully function right now. But we're here, ready to do the Friday edition of the Crossover Podcast.
We are here to do the Friday edition of the Crossover, the championship edition, the had no sleep, I have no freaking clue what's going to come out of my mouth over the next 30 to 40 minutes edition. I have scarfed half of an egg bagel sandwich from the Moxie Hotel in downtown Boston. I have no idea if this is actual eggs, actual bacon, or an actual bagel. I'm pretty sure it's not a real bagel, but, you know, that's the New Yorker in me. I do have coffee, and yeah, let's do it.
All right, well, let's start here, because if this had gone a different way, you and I would be preparing to hop on a flight to San Francisco for Game 7. And I got to tell you, if I was a betting man, I would have bet a lot on that. Because going into Game 7, or Game 6, I was very confident in the Celtics' ability to pull it off. I felt like they had been resilient all season long, that this would be the game that they wouldn't beat themselves. Turnovers have been a problem for this team all postseason, all during this final series. Game 6 would be when they rallied, forced a Game 7, anything could happen there, but that was not the case. The Celtics go down 103-90, and this game to me, Beck, was won and lost in the first quarter. Because the first quarter, the Celtics predictably came out hot, right? They built a 12-point lead in that first quarter. And it looked like they had a chance of running away with this thing. And, you know, making this game somewhat of a laugher. But Golden State responded in a championship way. They erased that 12-point lead. And they went into the second quarter with a 5-point advantage. So I thought that was the moment, that quarter was where this game was won and lost.
So it's really interesting, Chris, because we focus a lot on, look, Curry had an incredible series. He was the finals MVP unanimously. We focus on the offensive contributions that the Warriors got from Wiggins and at times from Jordan Poole and an occasional Klay Thompson revival. But it's the Warriors defense. that truly won this series and was the difference. And it was the Celtics who had the defense as their calling card, right? These are the 1-2 regular season defenses, Boston first, Warriors second during the regular season. And look, some of this may be Celtics inexperience. Some of it may be Celtics lack of playmaking. We'll get to that. Lack of polish. But the fact is, the Celtics defense did not have nearly the impact on the Warriors' ability to score as the Warriors' defense did on the Celtics' ability to score. In fact, all four games that the Warriors won in this series, they held Boston below 100 points. And on a couple of those, I think below 90. The Celtics couldn't freaking score, mostly because they couldn't keep the ball long enough. 23 turnovers total, including one team turnover that ended up in the totals. 23 turnovers, the high for the series for Boston. Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum with five each in a clinching game on their home court. Like, if that does not underscore, and look, they're in the finals. They were in the finals. They were the second best team of the season, so we don't want to go overboard. But Chris, if those turnovers, which were a series-long problem, and at their worst in the final game, don't underscore where the weakness of this team is, I'm not sure what does.
Yeah, the turnovers were a massive problem. And the one thing that I said going in was, you know, the Celtics will win game six if they don't beat themselves. Well, in part, they beat themselves. Credit the Warriors' defense, which was excellent. It was disciplined. It was as tight as you could possibly get throughout this series. But Boston, they just continue to throw the ball away. Jason Tatum finishes the leading scorer cumulatively in the playoffs. He also went over 100 turnovers in the postseason, which is
a record
for postseason turnovers. So they've got to clean that one up. So let's kind of unpack different layers of this. Let's start with Steph Curry on the positive side. Steph, Finals MVP, 34 points in Game 6, ruining my dark horse hopes for Andrew Wiggins to win Finals
you
MVP.
You tried.
But he gets it. Steph Curry, he gets it. Was this the crowning achievement of Steph Curry's career? Was this the, of all the things he's done, the two MVP awards, the three previous championships, the scoring, everything that he's accomplished, was this run the crowning achievement for Steph Curry?
I don't know about crowning achievement. I'm going to cop from The Wire and say all the pieces matter. Like, all the pieces of Steph's legacy and his resume matter, right? The first championship, which was pre-Kevin Durant, if we need to remind people. No, he didn't get the Finals MVP, whatever. We don't need to revisit the controversy. But Steph had driven a team to the championship. Not on his own. That was the strength in numbers team. He and Klay Thompson were like neck and neck in scoring, I believe, in that finals or in that playoff run. In general, those two, they were kind of like twin engines, right? And this one, Steph was distinctively, definitively the driving force of the Warriors' offense. He was the engine because this isn't the same Klay, and there is no Kevin Durant, and there's no reasonable facsimile of a Kevin Durant. And so this one, like, they all present differently. And, you know, the two that Steph won next to Kevin Durant, Steph still scored a boatload of points. They don't win those without him either. Durant was just a little bit more significant in those finals and won MVP of both of them. So, all right, so you ask crowning achievement. I will just say this, and I might be repeating myself to an extent. I never thought that Steph needed a Finals MVP. I didn't think he needed to do anything else specifically, period, to certify him as an all-time great. Back-to-back MVPs in the regular season, first time ever unanimous MVP of the regular season, the three championships, everything. Changing the game, of course. I don't think he needed it. But to the extent that there were still skeptics out there or people who were doing their damnedest to try to diminish Steph and pick apart his resume or pick apart at the things that he didn't have, great, fine. This checks that final box. He didn't have Finals MVP. Now he does. Unanimously, definitively. And I will say this. I do think there is something even more impressive about this one because he had less reliable help. I don't want to say he had less help, period. But Jeff Van Gundy on the podcast, and I asked Steve Kerr about this after the game, Jeff Van Gundy on the broadcast, I should say, said, this is the least talented team, Warriors team, to win the championship, the least talented of their four championships. And he didn't mean it as an insult. He meant it as praise for the job that Steve Kerr and his staff had done, and even that Steph had done, I would think, in elevating this group. But it's kind of hard to get around, right? Like, Kerr didn't want to kind of embrace that because it sounds like an insult, but it's to his roster. But they had a bunch of really good players, but about a lot of guys unproven. And Clay is not fully Clay yet. We'll see if he gets back there. And they didn't have Kevin Durant. So, like, in a lot of ways, if you take what Van Gundy said, like, that's part of what underscores this for Steph Curry as being even more impressive. Crowning achievement, again, I'm not sure he needed it. But everything you do past a certain point just kind of, you know, strengthens the overall resume and the legacy. And so it's definitely significant. I don't know if it was needed, but it was significant.
Yeah, I don't know if it was needed either, but this definitely burnishes his resume. And when you do start making those all-time pound-for-pound lists, it moves Steph Curry up. I don't know that you're going to be able to name 10 guys with better resumes, more accomplished, to have done more than Steph Curry. It's just like that, because I look at this series specifically, and yes, Steph had help. Andrew Wiggins was phenomenal. Klay Thompson made shots. But game four, Steph Curry strapped the Warriors to his back and pulled out a win in Boston that, if he didn't, would have ended the series. They go down 3-1 to the Celtics. They're not going to rally and win that one. In game six, late in that game, going into the fourth quarter, the Celtics had a chance. Like, they were there. They were 10 points down. Yep. Going into the fourth. That was still anybody's game going into the fourth. But in the fourth, Steph Curry, reading the numbers here, 13 points, 2 rebounds, 1 assist, a steal, 4 for 6 from the field, 4 for 4 from the free throw line. He dominated. He was the leading scorer in the fourth quarter for both teams. And you know, that's just an incredible accomplishment for Steph Curry to do that in a finals performance. And the Celtics started to charge. Steph Curry was there to beat them back. So I think this is... this definitely adds something to his resume. This definitely enhances the player that he is.
And you know me, Chris, I'm terrible with the lists, with rankings. I struggle with it. I don't enjoy it because it's just, I don't think there's an objective truth to these things most of the time. But all that said, without naming the names to actually count them, because I haven't done this exercise anytime recently, I mean, I think Steph was already knocking on top 15 minimum. I think he is top 15. I think he might be knocking on the door of top 10. And look, I think when we start doing that exercise, which we will not necessarily do this morning with me on no sleep and you on very little, but you count everything, right? You count the number of MVPs. You count how many times to the finals, how many championships, scoring titles, what, like everything factors in. And Steph has a lot of everything. He's got a lot of stuff. And if you have one title, it's hard to be a top 10 all-time player, right? If you've got two, if you've got three, if you've got four, if you've got five, like that is part of it if you were the driving force of those titles. So in his own time now, Steph is tied with LeBron James for 4 rings. He's tied with Shaq previous, you know, just the previous era at 4 rings. And he's one behind Kobe at 5, one behind Tim Duncan at 5, one behind Magic Johnson at 5. It's not just all about the rings. It's not just count the rings. There's everything else that goes into rating players, ranking players, all time, all that stuff. But that's a pretty big one if you were the driving force of multiple championship teams, as Steph has been. I'll also say this. It was interesting. After the game, Iguodala at one point just said flat out, like, without it, he there was no dramatic pause or anything else. He just said it matter-of-factly. Iguodala called Steph the best point guard of all time. And none of us had the presence of mind at 1 a.m. or whatever it was to say, Andre, could you just clarify? Are you saying that Steph is ahead of Magic Johnson? Because Magic is the consensus, absolute, no one's ever questioned, all-time number one point guard in NBA history, right? Like, we don't question that. It doesn't matter who comes along. It's Magic and then a bunch of other guys. And you can then assemble them 2 through 5 or whatever. But no one has displaced him ever. And maybe there's an argument now. I don't think there's a point guard you could put ahead of him other than Magic. Isaiah, not Stockton, not Chris Paul, not Jason Kidd, not Steve Nash. Like, I don't think there's a point guard. It's Magic at number one until further notice. Steph is no worse than number two. And if Iguodala or anybody else wants to make the argument, Steph versus Magic, there's probably a decent argument.
Yeah. No, there certainly is now, for sure. You know, if you just, and you've written about this extensively, but if you just put the resume of Steph Curry blank, without a name attached to it, you'd say that guy, all-time great. Top 10 player of all time. The championships, the MVPs, the All-Star, the All-NBA nods, everything. Greatest shooting percentage, through most three-pointers. Like, you'd, he's just, you know, I think he is top 10 right now, all-time in players. And I think you absolutely can make a case he's surpassed Magic Johnson, if not, or is at least very close behind him in terms of the point guard rankings. Let's look at the Celtics for a second here. You know, coming into this series, I know we said this on previous podcasts before the finals. The biggest concern I had about the Celtics' chances to win was, were they ready? And I hearken back to the days of Oklahoma City 10 years earlier when the Thunder came into the finals. Young Kevin Durant, young Russell Westbrook, young James Harden, young Serge Ibaka as well. I thought going into that series with Miami, as good as the Heat were, that the Thunder were the better team, but they weren't ready for the moment. They were overwhelmed by the moment. The Celtics, they looked overwhelmed at times by the moment, and that manifested itself in the number of turnovers that they committed, especially the ones they committed in these losses. The 23 turnovers, a series high for the Celtics in Game 6. So, how do you view the Celtics' loss? It's a bad loss one way or the other, you know, because you can't just say, well, they'll be back. That doesn't always happen. The Thunder were never back in the finals after that. But how do you view this Celtics loss in a big picture?
I don't see it as a major indictment for the obvious reasons. First time ever in the finals, going up against a dynasty, granted, not the strongest version of that Warriors dynasty, but still, like, the Warriors, like, you combine their absolutely phenomenal, disciplined, and annoying as hell defense, and they were all over them. You combine that with a generational offensive talent like Steph, and even just solid supporting cast, that's a lot for a young team in its first finals to go up against. And you're right, like, this happens. Teams break through, they're young, and we say, you know what, they'll be back. They've got it, and they tell themselves that too. Wow, we got a big window, everybody's young. It doesn't always happen that way. And in fact, a lot of times it doesn't. And you can't take it for granted. But, you know, Tatum just became a guy that was in the MVP conversation this season, right? Just became All-NBA this season. Jaylen Brown just keeps getting better. Like, I think they've got two phenomenal foundational pieces. Robert Williams with a breakout season. And who knows how different this series is if his knee is healthy, right? Like, dude, how many shots did that dude, did he block in the,
five,
the in
I game believe. Six? Yeah, five.
I mean, good Lord. And he's not even at full strength. So you've got this incredible pogo-sticking, shot-blocking young center, these two elite wings, Marcus Smart and all that he does, reigning defensive player of the year. You can't, that they didn't beat the Warriors should not be an indictment. And you can't be anything but optimistic, I think, about their immediate future. But they have stuff to address. They definitely do. And the East, as we've discussed, like, not getting any easier. The Bucks are going to be right back in the mix. The Sixers with a full season of Harden, you'd think, would be better. We'll see what Miami can do to kind of freshen their roster a little bit and you know, help out the older guys a little. The Nets, who the heck knows, but, like, they should be in the mix somewhere. Toronto is just getting better. Like, the East is going to be tough. So the Celtics, there's no guarantees, but there's nothing to dislike about the young core.
Let's unpack that, okay? Because, look, the Celtics, this will likely not be a very active offseason for them, because the 8 to 9 guys that they play are all basically under contract for next year. Al Horford's got a partial guarantee of about $19 million, but one way or the other, Al Horford's going to be back with the Celtics. The question, which is going to come up, is what do they do at point guard? Is there a need to supplement or even replace a Marcus Smart at that position? This team was sloppy with the basketball. I know you have pointed out some questions about needing to have a more natural floor leader out there, someone that can take control of games in key moments. Is that something that's even worth discussing for the Celtics this offseason?
I think it has to be, Chris. I mean, credit to Marcus Smart for taking himself from defensive specialist to defensive specialist who could shoot a little to defensive specialist who could shoot a little and playmake to, oh, wow, he's actually a legit starting point guard in this league. He's the only one who thought so, and he made himself into it. Like, I don't want to diminish that at all. Like he had a great season, period. But unless you believe that he's going to keep taking steps forward as a point guard, as a guy who can organize the team and make sure that, you know, guys are getting shots if they haven't touched the ball in a while, make sure that you're getting, you know, the best possible shot in crunch time, that the offense is organized in crunch time, that you're not stalling out, that you're not getting bogged down into a lot of one-on-one play, which is another problem that the Celtics had in this series. The Warriors kept lulling them into a lot of one-on-one play that they just could not execute on. So not enough ball movement. And you listen, that some of that could be on Ime Udoka as well. But I think a veteran point guard solves a lot of that stuff. And we talked about this on our previous podcast that, you know, and it was like I had mentioned a player I had talked to. It was Jamal Crawford, who later went on NBA radio and said all the same things. And so I realized, oh, okay, I didn't need to keep that conversation private. Jamal Crawford said, look, they need a Chauncey Billups type. I don't know who the current Chauncey Billups would be, but I think Jamal is onto something there. And it's not to say that Marcus Smart can't do it. I do think that having a veteran hand so that Smart's doing a little less, or so that in crunch time, maybe he is shifting to off guard, or they're sharing ball handling duties. You know, Jalen can play up at small forward and Jason Tatum can play up at power forward. Like there's a lot of versatility in this group. That's part of the Celtics' strength. I think having a veteran playmaker could only help, whether it's to supplant Marcus Smart and nudge him over one, or whether it's simply to come off the bench and provide stability at key moments. Whatever it may be, I would be shocked if the Celtics aren't at least looking around this summer.
Well, you can look around for veteran backup help. I mean, good luck finding it. It's, you know, players that you're describing don't exactly grow on trees. And I don't think the Celtics will, nor do I think they should address anything about the point guard position. I think the point guard position is perfectly fine. Yes.
Hold on, though. So you want them to stand pat?
Stand like, pat. Run it back.
Across the board.
Well, yeah, supplement, right? They've got three pretty big trade exceptions that they can use, and they have the basic $6.5 million mid-level exception that they can use. I want them to use one or more of them to get themselves something of a wing scorer in that mix. I know internally they're pretty high on Sam Hauser, who's a terrific three-point shooter, was not seen except for those garbage time minutes late in games. But I would like to see them go out and get and find some kind of springy 6'7 to 6'8 forward who can play multiple positions and who could fit
those
that rotation.
Those guys don't grow on trees either.
You're right. You're right. But I think the Celtics would be in an advantageous position now because, look, if you're a player out there that wants to win, you're looking at Boston saying, that's a situation I would like to be in. You've got a tough but a player's coach in Ime Udoka, who's had a lot of success with this team, a young core that knows its roles. And if you're like, they're not going to get him, but like a Pat Connaughton type, like if you're a Pat Connaughton, you'd be like, all right, well, maybe they should go get Pat Connaughton, by the way, because he's from the area and might as well go take a shot at him. But like someone like that would make a lot of sense in this mix and would improve this team on the fringes. I think that's all they need. Like, I said this on Tuesday. I was highly critical of Marcus Smart at the very beginning of the season. I was highly critical of the Celtics' decision to anoint him as the playmaker. But this team is in the finals in large part because of Marcus Smart. Because Marcus Smart being the point guard means if you're the Celtics, you lead the league in... I'm going to run through these real quick because I wrote about it a little bit. It's coming, a story that's going to be posted today on SI.com. Defensive efficiency, opponent field goal percentage, pick and roll defense, defense on drives, opponent's points per game in the paint, and field goal percentage at the rim. Marcus Smart is a big reason the Celtics are elite on the defensive end of the floor. And if you replace him, you're not going to get a guy that defends like him. You're just not. And right, whoever steps on the floor without him, you're going to be a lesser defensive team because of that. They do need someone, Howard. Like, their clutch time minute production all season long was terrible. That's something that needs to be addressed. But I think Marcus Smart is going to grow into this role. He's 28 years old, playing point guard for the first time full-time as a professional. You're telling me he's not going to get better next season with another full offseason to improve at playing that spot? I mean, not having to deal with the first 2 months of a season again where you're adjusting to new roles, I think Marcus Smart's going to come back next year as a much more polished playmaker at that position.
I would never want to sell a guy short, especially someone who's worked as hard as he has to evolve his game and to become a more complete player, right? So I'm never going to sit here and tell you, like, he can't or that he won't. But I do disagree with you on part of the premise of, well, they're elite in all these defensive categories because Marcus Smart is the point guard, and anything you do to mess with that will possibly knock them down. Listen, Steph Curry was never considered a great defender. He's now become a good, solid defender where he was once a minus defender. But the bottom line is, like, the war, and granted, it's a sliding scale, right? If you're as elite offensively as Steph is, you can afford to not be as great defensively and have everybody else pick up the slack. But the bottom line is, if you slot in a new point guard for the Celtics who is a offensive and playmaking, ball handling plus, who will make everybody else better and get them better shots so that you are more efficient offensively as a team, that should make up for whatever you might lose defensively. But you're not losing that much because Marcus Smart's still out there. And we're not talking about ejecting Marcus Smart and sending him elsewhere. We're just saying shift him over to off guard and play everybody up a position. Like, I don't like, or maybe he's coming off the bench as a sixth man, which wouldn't be a terrible role either. He's not, listen, he was defensive player of the year, Chris, a little controversial in some quarters of NBA Twitter. But he was not the sole reason that they're a great defensive team. Tatum and Brown had a lot to do with that. Robert Williams had a lot to do with that. Al Horford had a lot to do with that. I think this Celtics team is going to be elite defensively regardless of how you mix and match those guys because they have multiple plus defenders, and it's them as a group that makes them a great defensive team. It's not any one guy who is responsible the way it is with, say, Rudy Gobert in Utah.
No, it's not. But look, I've lived through different iterations of Celtics teams with minus defenders at point guard, whether it was Isaiah
Thomas.
Those
were big minuses.
Okay, well, I mean, like, but to the not going to grow on trees argument, like, you're not going to find, like, an above-average point guard who's also a better playmaker than Marcus Smart. Like, I don't even know who that is. Like, is Ricky Rubio the answer?
We've talked about Rubio. Like, Rubio's still, like, a good defender and an excellent passer, right? And he's a guy who will organize your offense. Yeah. I'm trying to think of who else is that. I think Dragic is a free agent again too, right? I mean, he's got a lot of miles on him
and a minus defender at that. Like, that's, yeah. I wouldn't know. Look, that to me is not the issue for this team. I actually don't think this team has many issues. I think they need to grow together, get more experience, add something around the fringes, and they'll be in a position next year to do the exact same thing.
Let me ask you this then. They went seven games against the Bucks and won, importantly, against the defending champs, granted without Chris Middleton. They went seven games the next series against the Heat, a team that best regular season record, but not exactly, you know, a offensive juggernaut, the Heat. The Celtics were squeaking by Seven games means you were kind of squeaking by, and then they got totally outclassed by the Warriors. That was like the
six but there's gonna be organic improvements with this team. Like Tatum will be in the MVP conversation next year if he's healthy. Like he will probably be in that discussion. Jaylen Brown will be back in the All-Star discussion, probably be an All-Star next year. Grant Williams took a huge leap this year, non-factor in the finals, but he's going to be a lot better. Robert Williams, you know, played on one leg the entire playoffs, came back from knee surgery after 1 month. He presumably is going to be better. There's just a lot of room for organic growth, Howard, with this team. That I don't think changing anything is going to help them.
Unless it's a fringe change. I'm not advocating dramatic changes. I'm not saying like and listen, if they just followed the Chris Mannix plan of standing pat, a couple minor things around the edges, and just let them continue to grow because they're young enough to keep getting better, I think that's fine. I wouldn't criticize that if that's what they did. I do think that in this league, it's always tough to stand pat, even for a young team that's just now broken through.
Well, I mean, Golden State kind of stood pat. You know, I know they added Kevin Durant, but the core of this team is the same group of guys. They just won a championship with the same group of guys that they've had for 10 years now. How long has it been since all three of those top guys have been together?
They're a tough analogy only because, you know,
I don't know. They make Tatum is Curry, you know, Brown is Thompson,
right, but
Smart
the entire,
is Green, like, you know, yeah, I mean
the entire supporting cast around the Warriors core three has obviously changed. But that's also because we're in year eight of the run. And
yeah, you're right.
Like with the Bulls in the 90s, like it was a completely different cast around Pippen and Jordan for the second three-peat, right? Like that happens. And the Celtics are at a different stage. So it's a hard comparison. But look, they're a really strong and very young group. There is absolutely a case to be made that you don't need to change a thing. And the fact is, like some of the teams that they're battling with at the top of the East have their own issues that are far deeper, right? Like if nobody changed a thing right now and you said, forget who do you favor? Who do you have the most concerns about? I got all kinds of concerns about the Sixers. I might have a couple about the Bucks, but not major as long as they're healthy. Like I don't really, like what's there to really fret about with the Bucks? All kinds of asterisks on the Nets.
Miami's getting older. Kyle Lowry older, Jimmy Butler a year older.
Yep.
You know, that's...
Yeah, so look, I have fewer concerns about the Celtics. Look, I think the one team that would scare me if I'm the Celtics, if I haven't made any changes at all, is a healthy Bucks team.
Yeah,
I'm not,
I agree.
Like the,
I agree.
The, yeah, the rest of them have their own caveats and concerns, but the Bucks are tough as hell, especially when they're actually healthy.
Right.
And I'm not trying to asterisk anything, by the way. I'm just saying, like, the, you know, that's who they have to reckon with next year.
Yeah, you beat the teams that are in front of you. No question about that. All right, if you're done trashing Marcus Smart, I want to turn to the Warriors to finish up. You know, it's funny. Golden State, like, we look at this. Four championships in 8 years. This team is a dynasty. They don't look anywhere near done at this point. Curry is still very much in his prime. Presumably, Thompson's going to come back and be a better version of himself next year with a full offseason to be healthy and get all the way back physically. Draymond looks like he can play at this kind of level for at least a few more years. He's never going to be a great offensive player, though he made some three-point shots on Thursday night. But like the core of this team is intact and ready to return next season. And they've got like, they've got basically like the Oklahoma City Thunder on their bench, right? You've got three high lottery picks sitting on your bench getting zero meaningful minutes in these playoffs with James Wiseman, who didn't play a minute this season because of a knee injury, Jonathan Kuminga, who showed some real flashes during the regular season, got some rotational minutes and looked like he could be a player, Moses Moody, less sure about, but he also had some brief moments of talent there. Like what Golden State does this offseason is going to be really interesting. Have they seen enough, specifically in Kuminga, to go into the next season with basically the status quo as well? Like, and do you incorporate these younger guys a little bit more and take some of the pressure off your core four at the top? Or do they look to package some of these players to get one of those stars that's out there? Because there is going to be an incredible market for James Wiseman, for Kuminga, and maybe to a lesser degree, Moses Moody. So what do you think? Like, what do you think Bob Myers' first order of business? I mean, these are the ultimate first world problems that he has right yes. now. But it's an interesting choice that the Warriors will probably have to make this offseason.
So one of the first stories I did early in the season, Chris, if you remember, was about the Warriors choosing this dual track, right? We are going to keep contending for titles now with the core of our dynasty, and we're going to keep all these young guys and plan for the future. We're going to do both tracks simultaneously. It almost never happens. It's really hard to pull off. And their fans, a lot of their fans were not happy with it. This was a controversial stance that Myers had taken and that the majority owner Joe Lacob had taken, and very publicly so, where Lacob had said, no, we're not going to bottom out. When these guys are done, when Curry and Clay and Draymond, we're going to have the next group ready to go. And it's ballsy, man. Like, it's ambitious. It's audacious. It is very difficult to pull off. And, dude, they just did it. Like, I mean, anybody who said you should have cashed out on Wiseman, Moody, Kuminga, whatever, trade whoever you had to get whoever it was going to be. You know, Bradley Beal wasn't truly available, but whoever it was going to be, the immediate help, because you got to capitalize now. I myself probably said some version of this at some point. A lot of Warrior fans wanted that. And here they are sitting here in mid-June, champions again, without having spent any of those young guys as trade capital, and they're all still there. I talked to Joe Lacob before game five. Story up at SI.com right now. My overview of this Warriors championship, how they got here, the decisions they made along the way. And Lacob, this is like two games ago. This is before they're up 3-2 at the time that I, or excuse me, it was still 2-2 at the time that I spoke with him. He was basically saying, I told you so. I told you so. We did it. We pulled it off. And they're really happy about it. I don't think, to answer your question, that is going to move him to now want to reverse course and trade any of those young pieces. I think this is going to embolden him that much more to say, no, we've got this. And the fact is, like, you said it, Kuminga looked really good in flashes during this regular season and a couple moments in the playoffs. Moody charting out as a possible really great 3-and-D guy. And I know people, like, there's a lot of people, including some Warriors fans that I follow on Twitter, who are very down on Wiseman because of a couple of missed seasons because of injury. Okay, I get it.
Yeah, be careful. Guys, like Joel Embiid missed a couple of seasons, too, with an injury. Not comparing the two players, but nope. Joel Embiid was the third pick in his draft. Wiseman was number two. Like, the talent is there in James Wiseman.
The talent is absolutely there. And if you talk to the Warriors anytime over the last year or so, like, they are so excited about this guy. And he's a good dude. He is, you know, all the things that you can't teach, right? Tall, long, got a motor, got hops, can handle the ball, can shoot a little, can play inside and out, can be a defensive force. Like, if you just run this Warriors team back and Wiseman is healthy and, you know, can accelerate his development a little bit, the potential for them to get better just by having a young seven-footer, athletic seven-footer in the starting lineup is incredible. Mm-hmm. That advantage alone, he was the number two pick for a reason. And it's way too early for people to be writing him off. Kuminga, Moody make some strides. Like, I tend to think that the Warriors, like, who knows, you know, that they'll, you know, stuff around the edges, the Bielitzas and all that stuff. But they've got Poole, who we hadn't even mentioned yet. Between Jordan Poole, Kuminga, Moody, and Wiseman, you've got four young, very promising players. And the way that Lacob described it to me, again, this is in the story that's up at SI.com right now. People, go read it, please. Lacob basically says, like, I see us pretty much doing this for the rest of the decade. And I see our core guys playing into their late 30s and approaching 40 because we have these guys who can take some of the minutes from them as they go. And because we're in a time when, you know, because of modern developments in sports science and medicine and everything else, guys can play later. So he's looking at it as we're nowhere near done.
Yeah. I mean, look, if that's the track they want to follow, at some point, it's going to become like the most expensive roster in NBA history. You're going to be approaching like $500 million when you factor in luxury tax in what you're paying per season. But if Joe Lacob is willing to open the checkbook, open the vault, by all means, that's definitely a way that you can go. I think in addition to everything you said, one of the bigger reasons that we won't see real activity from the Warriors this offseason is that, you know, in order to get one of these big name players that we've been talking about, whether it's Bradley Beal, Damian Lillard, somebody else that's out there, you've got to have salary filler. At one point, that was believed to be Andrew Wiggins. Andrew Wiggins is no longer salary filler. Andrew Wiggins is no longer a guy with a bad contract. He's a player you want to extend his contract this offseason. Yes. He is an essential piece of this team. Jason Tatum had 13 points in Game 6. Some of that was on Jason Tatum because he looked exhausted for most of this series. But part of it, a good part of it, was Andrew Wiggins hounding him. He played excellent defense on Tatum throughout the series. He has been excellent defensively throughout these playoffs. He made shots. He's become a much better three-point shooter. You're not including Andrew Wiggins in a deal as salary filler. If you're going to trade Wiggins, you want something better than him, just him, back in return. So without that big salary to trade, you really can't do any deals because you're not trading Steph or Klay or Draymond. Like, that's not happening. So, like, Andrew Wiggins may have just forced their hand altogether by being as great as he was this series. The guy just turned 27 in February, Howard. Like, he's theoretically just hitting his athletic prime, his NBA prime. You don't deal away guys like that. So I think one of the players we talked about, maybe it's probably most likely Kuminga at this point, because I think he's the most NBA ready of the three young guys, is probably going to make an impact with this team next year. All three of those young guys will probably enable the Warriors to really scale back on the minutes of Steph, Klay, and Draymond during the regular season. It is a phenomenal problem to have if you're Golden State, to have these three young players ready to go. Ready to go. Year two for Kuminga and Moody. It's technically year three for Wiseman, but he didn't play all this season. But to have these guys next year potentially be really able to contribute, so you don't have to go out and spend money on some veteran player in the offseason if you don't want to. They're in great shape. They're in great shape with this group. There's no question about it.
And it's such a wild contrast, Chris, to where we were just 3 years ago, right? We're all writing obituaries for this team and eulogies for this team in 2019 because Klay has just gone down with the ACL and Durant's gone down with the Achilles and they're just looking kind of tired and broken, and you know Durant's leaving, and it's not out of disrespect for the franchise or any of those players. It's just that 5 years, like, that was already unprecedented in the modern era to go to five straight finals, and that just looked like it was going to be really hard to revive this thing. And here we are 3 years later, not only talking about them having won a fourth championship, but having so much promising youth around the older core that we are legitimately talking about they don't need to make any changes. They just need to keep spending a lot of money to keep these guys together. Like, you cannot say enough about, look, they were really freaking smart. Like, it was great when Steve Kerr, during the post-game championship celebration, the trophy presentation, Lisa Salters from ESPN is saying, oh, Steve Kerr, come over here. And Kerr immediately, within a minute, is shouting out, saying, no, Bob Myers needs to come over here. For them to take, and granted, a lot of things had to go right, and Kevin Durant had to agree to it, but for them to say, Kevin Durant, you're leaving anyway, participate in a sign-and-trade, a dual sign-and-trade that brings us D'Angelo Russell, so that they could then have a contract and a decent young player to trade later, knowing full well that the Timberwolves, among others, would be interested. And D'Angelo Russell gets them Andrew Wiggins and the pick that became Kuminga. Like, for a team that was already had a championship core and was and had the capability of getting back there, to be able to pull off those kinds of moves to make the roster younger and more talented. And I know, look, Wiggins was, you know, he was definitely diamond in the rough when they got him. No, people around the league weren't clamoring to try to get Andrew Wiggins, partially because of the contract and partially because they just didn't think that much of him anymore. And they pulled that off. Part of the reason they were able to pull that off is because they did one of the most painful things Bob Myers told me that he's ever had to do, that he still hasn't gotten over, he told me, again, in the story on SI.com right now, which is trading Iguodala. The only way to do the dual sign-and-trade was to trade Iguodala because of hard cap issues and weird salary cap mechanisms and a bunch of bullshit that people don't need to know about. But suffice to say, they could not have done the dual sign-and-trade Durant for D'Angelo Russell without first dumping Iguodala's contract on Memphis. And it pained Bob to do it because he loves Iguodala. And to their credit, to everybody's credit, Iguodala came back you know, 2 years later.
Might have seen the last of him, too, by the way. I thought there was a purpose for putting him out there on the floor in those closing seconds of Game 6. Hadn't played all game. They put him out there, and I think that might have been the end for Andre Iguodala.
Quite possibly. I mean, the back issues he's had and everything else, he had a hard time staying on the floor this season. Yeah. But, man, listen, even if he hadn't played a minute this year, you saw it every timeout. Sometimes he didn't even need to wait till the timeouts. He's coaching up those young guys all the time. Iguodala is smart as hell, as smart as any player I've ever come across in this league, and is a coach on the floor and is a great leader in that locker room. And them getting him back was really important too. But again, like, the moves that they have made to get back here took creativity and audacity. And, you know, I know we give him shit because Lacob said years ago, we're light years ahead. And that was like, you know, a lightning rod comment and the kind of thing that made them sound arrogant and full. Fine. They have done some light years ahead stuff. It always takes luck in this league, as any coach or player will tell you, but they have done some really smart things to put themselves back here besides.
Well, they've got their next Andre Iguodala already, Gary Payton II. Like, he's like the heir apparent and played great defense in this finals.
They're going to have to pay him too.
Yeah, but they were what? I think they were 4-1 with Gary Payton in the finals. Like, he was a difference maker on the defensive end of the floor. Well, Howard, you know who's going to have to make changes soon? Me, because I had that ice cream tower last night, and that was rock bottom for me at these finals. I've been avoiding the junk food at the Garden for all postseason. I didn't last night, so I'm going to go take a nap and then try to run this off every day for the rest of my summer. So
I'm gonna go fly home and then sleep for the next week. How about that?
Sounds like a plan, Howard. We will reconvene next week.
Always a pleasure, my friend. See you soon.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.